This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 354 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Raquel M. To find out more about what a co-producer is and how you can find out maybe to become a co-producer, if that made sense in English, stay to the end. We'll give you a little more information.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with chapter 21, entitled
We Have Ignition!
I don't know why I say it like that. I have to. It's a compulsion.
So this is the chapter where Jem learns to drive.
Not
a wagon.
It's the one where Tom Christie's a...
Oh, Lord. So Bree and Roger come into the big house where it's just about dinner time, and they're both crazy excited to share some big news. Mrs. Bug not only assumed she was pregnant, they were pregnant, she blurts it out and then goes on and on and on and on about how it's been so long. I've been thinking about adding stuff to your food to make you take, and then goes on about Roger knowing his business. Whew. And then Jem didn't know what to think about being offered a brother or a sister, and she even gives him a wee sweetie to celebrate.
I mean, this is on par with going up to a woman in public.
Oh, Lord.
And assuming she's pregnant and asking, when are they due? Don't you never assume. Never assume. And you know why? Because it's none of your business either way.
Either way, yeah.
Never assume. Assuming is going to make her feel bad and you feel bad. So just don't do it.
Bree tries to correct her, but nope, she's cut off. And then she, Mrs. Bug, wants to go get Art to tell him the news. And she shares how she never thought she, Bree, would get around to it. And how all the women thought she might have turned cold toward her husband.
Mm-mm.
Gracious. See how this, it just piles on.
It spirals.
Yes. Spirals and piles. Yes.
Just let the lady talk, man. You're making yourself look like a...
She has to harshly interrupt and say, this is Bree now. Bree has to harshly interrupt and say that she is not pregnant. And Jamie's like, okay, then let's eat.
Cool. Can we have some chicken?
I got a stomach here. Typical dude. But also trying to what's the word? Not defray.
De-escalate.
Trying to get them back on track to yes to eat, but also to kind of, de-escalate the situation. Mrs. Bug, I wrote, is upset, but... She's not, she's upset, but what is she? Mrs. Bug is butt hurt. That's the word. She's butt hurt at being yelled at and huffs around, like clanging, slamming doors, clanging dishes, all of that. And Bree's like, nope, I am not going to share some news. Because Roger was, I think, trying to get her to say, well, you know, we can share the news. She's like, uh-uh, not happening. Because evidently, nothing is good news unless it's me knocked up.
No, it's not only that, but nothing you say at
how
that
do you
point.
Top it?
It's going to matter. You're going to be like, oh,
I got a match.
What
the heck's a match? But you're not pregnant? Oh, damn it. Right?
Cool.
She even jumps on Roger. Verbally jumps on Roger. And now
she also literally jump on him as well?
I mean, that's later.
Okay. I'm like.
So as I said, Mrs. Bug had given Jem, to celebrate this new sister or brother, she gives him a piece of marmalade, I think marmalade candy. And Jem's like, I don't care what's going on here. I ain't going to miss this. And he puts it in his mouth and then covers his mouth to say, uh-uh, mom, no one's taking this away. Because he could tell there was tension coming on. It wasn't celebration. So he's now, as young childs are wont to do, he's now got sticky, drooly marmalade drool down his face and shirt. And when Bree sees this, she's livid. She's like, and that is his last clean shirt. So before things could get worse, Roger's like, okay, that's bye. Mm-hmm. Bodily picks her up and they go home.
Oh, that's right. She doesn't jump on him. He picks her up.
Yes.
I remembered her being elevated and him being underneath as they walked.
And the rest of them have dinner. And poor Jem is asking about when he gets a wee brother.
Seriously, so much damage with one assumption.
Oh, gracious.
Because you know she's never going to hear anything else from that kid. And that kid is now fixated. And he's going to be sad when you're like, no, sorry, dude. There's not a sibling growing currently inside of your mother. And then they're sad because they thought they were going to have this thing. And then they're not going to have this thing. And children are irrational.
Exactly. And that's why. And it's not to diss
kids.
If you
recall, no.
It's all kids. Kids are black and white.
And if you recall, in a previous novel, when young Ian was born and, or was it Ian? No, it was Janet. When Janet was born and Jamie was hiding with her in the closet, young Jamie came in.
That was Ian.
No, I think it was later. Because young Jamie was still a baby and he had come in and she had just given birth and the soldiers were like, well, where's the babe? And she was like, I lost it. It died. And then Jamie was like, what? The baby died. And threw this giant like toddler fit because he thought he'd lost a sibling. It wasn't Ian. It was a different one, but it was the same kind of a situation. But because young Ian was too small. He was so much younger than old Ian. Not old Ian. Old Jamie. Older Jamie.
Jamie hid in the closet with wee Ian.
Was it? Because that timeline doesn't work for me.
It was just before he gave himself up. And he went to prison and then went to Ardsmuir. And so that was about 7 years or so, right? 7, 8. In this chapter, it's 8. So who knows? It's 7, it's 8, it's whatever it Diana decides it is. And then so if Ian's about 7 or 8 by the time he gets...
It wasn't Ian. It was Jamie. Jamie was the one who was crying about the baby who he thought was dead.
No. Jamie may have done the crying. Ian was the baby Jamie was holding is what I'm saying.
Okay. I know it was a baby and I know that young Jamie was old enough, like 4 or 5, I thought. He was little, which made me think it was wee Janet that he threw this fit about.
That would have been season 3, right? Just before for the TV show.
If it was Ian, it would have been 3. But like I said, I feel like it was way earlier than that because it was wee Jamie was like 4 or 5, like little.
Well, okay, forget who it was. Think of what the conditions were. He was hiding because if he were caught, he would have been arrested.
He was always hiding.
Yes, but she didn't have 17 kids when he was there at 23.
No, he wasn't. That's what I said. There weren't 17 kids. There was 2. She was pregnant and she had one. Okay, it's in Voyager. It says, Jenny tells them the baby died. Young Jamie hears this and flies into a grief-filled rage, shouting at the soldiers who've killed his brother.
Yeah, I'm not debating that.
Well, it was definitely Voyager, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yes, it is Ian. But baby timeline, Ian. Yeah.
It's wackadoodle. I'm telling you, and he's her youngest. So she has like 6 kids or 5 kids.
Which means that he's way too old to be throwing this kind of a tantrum. That's what I'm taking away from that. Okay. Back to the chapter. Mrs. Bug's a busybody.
I thought you were going to say something else, but yeah. At the big house, Jamie says that Bree was provoked and she shouldn't have to apologize.
He's not wrong.
I agree. And Claire is worried that the imbalance here might affect them not so fun-wise.
I think they should be worried because Mrs. Bug does a lot of the cooking.
I was about to say, yeah. And they've already... Oh, I just laughed so loud my cat got freaked out. I'm sorry, baby girl. And then there's a knock at the door. You want to tell us who our newest friend is?
It's a is who it is.
There's a lot of reference to that in this episode, and we haven't even, like, had a real one.
He is a Tom Christie is at the door like a
So, yes, enter me, as Hamilton would say, enter Tom Christie. He was shaken, and he had a blood-stained cloth around one hand, and he was pale and sweating. He's come for treatment. Jamie is there, and he watches Tom Christie and Claire with caution. They go into her surgery and she begins to work. Her plan is to work on his hand and see what's going on. She surveys the damage to his hand. It's a slice his skin was sliced at the base of the thumb, I think, and he had just nicked a tendon. And then he passes out and he falls forward onto Claire and she yells for help. Jamie comes over and like picks him up and bends his head down forward so his he would not pass out further or again. And Jem standing in the doorway looking on, but not afraid of the blood. I mean, look who his gran is, whom he sees all the time. This is nothing new. Jamie offers to get Tom a dram, but Tom declines. But he does say he'll take some wine.
And then Jamie
quotes a passage from the Bible that mentions wine, and Christy grimaces. Quote, I had noticed before that, like some Protestants, Tom Christie regarded the Bible as being a document addressed specifically to himself and confided to his personal care for prudent distribution to the masses. Thus, he quite disliked Catholics, i.e. Jamie, quoting casually from it. I had also noticed that Jamie was aware of this and took every opportunity to make such quotes. Yeah. Unquote. I love it. I love the back and forth. I love it. They're both okay. So basically here, speaking of being a D, Jamie was just a D to Tom, right?
Well, here's the thing.
He was trying to on purpose.
You're right. They clearly needle each other. Yes. And you can tell they have a shared past, right? So they have a knowledge of each other that is deeper than acquaintance because of their time in Ardsmuir. But like Christy takes it overboard.
Oh, girl.
Like, that's my point. That was the move. Like,
yes.
The back and forth, like, it's almost like banter. It's almost like foreplay, right? And then all of a sudden when Tom Christy slams it home, it's like, dude, too far.
I love this. I so hope we get this back and forth, this layered relationship between Jamie and Tom Christy in the show. And I'm hoping that we will have room for it since they got rid of so much stuff and shoved it into season 5. Okay. So basically what I'm saying is I hope that it was worth the shoving it all into season 5. I don't think they did it badly. I liked season 5. What I'm saying is, as a book reader, it was a lot of change.
I prefer them shoving things in from other books than making it up in the writer's room.
Oh, girl, I don't disagree with that. And I'm not disagreeing, like I have a choice, with what they did. I'm just saying I hope that the reason they did that was to, as I said a million times, to give us more space for this book, which is the longest one thus far. We don't know about Bees yet. Bees could be the longest. We don't know.
We don't even know if they're going to have a chance to film Bees. So let's just focus on this one.
No, Summer. The book is the longest. I'm not talking about the filming. A Breath of Snow and Ashes is the longest book, but I could be wrong once Bees comes out. We don't know because we don't have a length yet for Bees. That's all I'm saying. So I love this back and forth. I love the layered relationship. So what exactly had happened to Tom? He was cutting rushes when the knife slipped. Okay, well, fair enough. Why did the knife slip? She looks at his right hand and notices that he suffers from Dupuytren's contracture. Or it would be called such once that dude, some baron, was born 60 years later. But she couldn't call it that. But it's caused by a thickening and shortening of the fibrous sheath that keeps tendons in place. And his case had gotten much worse since she'd seen his hand last. A while back, it would have been an easier fix, and now not so much. But he says he does not desire her to fix his hand. And she tells him, she's like, okay, fine. Okay, trying to see how to put this without using too many bad words. Her reply is basically, fine, bitch. If I don't fix it, you're not going to be able to write. You're not going to be able to do this. You're not going to be able to do that. And she hit him where she knew it would do the most good and slash be the most effective in his pride, right? His part of his pride is built up in his knowledge, his education. He won't lose that if he loses his hand, but he will lose the ability to write. People go to him. They pay him to write things. And so he will lose this prestige if he loses the use of his hand. So she knows exactly where to go. And that was smart. She says, if I don't operate within 6 months, it'll be useless. And as I said, she uses his one vanity. And I don't even say a vanity, but against him, his ability to write and his education. Jamie dumps on, he dumps onto the situation. He goes, best listen to her. And then he says, I ken what it's like to try and write with a stiff finger. And the difference was, Claire pointed out, Jamie's wasn't getting worse. Ooh. There is so much one-upmanship between these two men. It's thick. So while they don't physically come to blows, Christy is someone whose faith is strong, like Jamie's, who knows his stuff, like Jamie, who is educated, like Jamie, and whose self-worth is wrapped up in his ability to do a particular thing. For Tom, it's his ability as an educated man to write and share knowledge. For Jamie, it's his identity as a leader of men. But remember, even Jamie didn't want to live without a leg when there was a chance Claire would have to cut it off after the snake bite. So anyone is in danger of feeling this. It's a human thing. But seeing these two actually similar men, leaders also in a way, is very entertaining. And we learn, this is before, remember, I take notes as I go. So I hadn't gotten to later in the chapter at this point. We learn at some point, yes, Ginger, in just a few paragraphs. We learn at some point that Christy wasn't fighting. So how did he end up in Ardsmuir? He was captured along the road on his way back to Edinburgh or thereabouts. It's kind of tragic. And so I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't exactly blame Jamie for his being in Ardsmuir. So not for his arrest, but just kind of not for his physical presence at Ardsmuir. I take that back. But for the way he was treated or the way he wasn't treated at Ardsmuir. He wasn't treated. Jamie being the king of men, right? And being the natural leader there took a shine or a spotlight off of Tom. Otherwise, because Tom was used to being that person in his surroundings.
I know, but look at his new surroundings. He basically entered a prison gang, and it was already established. And you know, it's like these people went through something together. It's like how he's friends with Jamie now. They would not be friends if they hadn't spent that time together in Ardsmuir. This connection they have now would not be happening.
Yes. And
especially not the same way, but it's the same way when he entered the prison, it was like they already had their clique. It was like a giant clique. So it's like the only way you can't be a clique by yourself. You have to get in there and...
Correct. But his clicky? No, not his clicky. His, I would say leadership, but he was the ish leader of the Protestants. That's so it was kind of two camps, and that's why he had them all made Masons. So that would bring them all together. But so he was a mini leader. He just didn't like the fact that Jamie was more respected than him.
Get used to it, buddy.
I know.
You're never going to be anybody's book boyfriend.
So he had been, as I said, like a leader of the Protestant gang, I guess you say, but arriving after Jamie had established himself as the de facto leader of the Jacobites there overall, he didn't like that someone else was leader and could win men's hearts. And was the fact that he was Catholic made it even worse. How could a Catholic, how could this papist, this idolatrous person be a leader? How could he be respected, right? And here on the ridge, quote, the simple fact was that people came to Jamie for help more often than they did to Christy. Jamie had widespread, not that, no.
What?
No, I don't know what that was. Sped? Jamie had
sped. What's a widespread? Is that like when you walk with a really wide gate?
But fast?
Is that what bow-legged people do?
Oh, Lord, I don't know. Jamie had widespread respect and admiration despite his crippled hand. Christy was not a personally popular man. He might well lose what social position he had if he lost his ability to write, unquote. And as I said, also, Jamie's condition wasn't getting worse. Another difference between them. Most of Jamie's patients were men and Highlanders, many of whom had been soldiers. Christy was none of that, except, of course, he was a man. He was a townsman from Edinburgh. And so here we get a little bit more into his background. He'd been a Jacobite supporter, but never fought. So not only is he at risk for losing basically the rest of his standing in this Ridge community, right? Like the fisher folk, he's not a farmer. I'm sure he helps out when, you know, he needs to, when everyone's doing haymaking, maybe he was helping. I don't know. But he already, like the fisher folk who were probably uneducated, but they needed to learn a new way of life. Okay, fair enough. Tom Christie didn't necessarily have to learn a new way of life. He probably had his own kitchen garden and that kind of thing. But as far as huge crops that everyone kind of put in for and worked together on, he wasn't a farmer. He was a schoolmaster and a clerk type person. So Claire fixes his wound and tells him to send Malva to pick up some ointment for him. And in a week, she'll take the stitches out. Quote, "I'll take care of your right hand then too, shall I?" Unquote. And then Jamie adds, "Go on then, Tom. It's not to trouble you. No, but a wee nick. I've had worse." Unquote. So Jamie is kind of smoothly taunting Tom into, "I can take it, can't you?"
But doesn't Tom start walking out of the room and then come up with his dick, come back, and then turn around and be like, "Nah." And then he turns around and he's like, "Peace," and he's out. He's like, "Mic drop, I'm an asshole."
Part of Jamie saying that is saying, you know, "I can take it, can't you?" But also mentioning obliquely, or maybe not, I think Jamie, okay, having read the rest of the chapter, I think Jamie means, because they're talking about hands now, right? Jamie means hands. If I can take her doing something to my hand, you can take her doing, like, can't you take it? Aren't you a man? You know, and what? But what he does here, and Tom probably would have gone there on his own, but what he does here is he opens up when he says, "I can take it," or when he says language to that effect, he opens up the conversation. Not that he's not welcoming it, but he opens it up, at least someone's in thought, to, of course, the scars on his back.
Until Diana explained it, I was thinking, did he know he got his hand all jacked up and buggered by blackjack? Like, was that common knowledge? Is he making fun of him because he was buggered?
On the ridge, I think it's just Claire, Jamie, Roger, and Bree who know.
Which became clear when Diana explained it. But I had that moment because I thought he was talking about his hand for hand. Like, at least my hand scar will be honorable. And I'm like, wait, what he did was honorable. I mean, he took one for the team. That's what Jamie did, right? Come on.
Oh, Jamie took a lot for the team.
I'm just saying.
So, as I said, Tom agrees to the surgery, but as he leaves, he throws a parting shot at Jamie. Quote, "At least it will be an honorable scar, won't it, McDo?" Unquote. And I love it. I love it when Jamie gets busy. After Tom leaves, he says, "Why you weep, peasant?" Mm-hmm. And Claire isn't quite sure what had happened. She's like, "What?" So that right there. Well, okay, that's not true. I think you can see it in two places, although one is much longer lasting. So what I wrote was, that's the ignition right there. Although you could say it happened early either. You could say that Jamie ignited it. But again, remember the chapter title, right? Ignition. So this is, or at least this chapter, is a chapter of ignition between Jamie and Tom, or a reignition, because it's always been there. It's like it's always been kind of festering sub-ignition, right? It's been ready to flame. Now it's starting to flame. But you could also say that Mrs. Bug ignited Brianna, right? And the fact that she made those, which we'll almost get to in a second, she made those matches. So there's a lot of things that could go with the theme, literal and figurative, as in most chapters, with ignition. So Claire hadn't heard him called McDo by Tom ever. And she knew that Tom didn't speak Gaelic. So she doesn't understand this. And also, what does honorable scar mean?
You know, thinking you brought up the matches, I know they're coming up later, but I feel like those matches, like striking a piece of wood on something else and having fire, would have been pretty f-ing exciting.
Yes.
Like, I'm not saying I think she could have trumped baby.
I'm not. Okay. What I'm about to say is, I hope it does not sound callous. We're talking about a work of fiction here. And so all of this is fictional, right? Or at least the story is fictional. So when I say this, I am not belittling anyone's struggle. I hope you understand that. So because I know the answer is not everyone can do this. But comparatively, in this time, at this time, in this fictional story, comparatively, practically any woman could get pregnant. Practically. Okay. I'm not saying there aren't women who have trouble, had trouble back then. No, I mean, apparently Brianna's having trouble. So it's obviously not true what I'm saying. But no one could make matches.
I know. It's not so much that anyone could get pregnant, because that's not true. Not everyone can. I know. But what I'm saying is that no one could really prevent it. So it was happening all the time.
That's much more true. That is much more true. That's true. So back to the Honorable Scar. Jamie has to explain to Claire, quote, 8 years he lived in a cell with 40 men who had the Gaelic, and he wouldna lower himself to let a word of such a barbarous tongue pass his lips. He'd speak in English, and if it was a man who had no English, why then he'd just stand there, dumb as a stone, till someone came along and interpreted for him, unquote. And then Claire realizes what he meant by Honorable Scar, and she says, quote, why that little bastard?
Exactly.
Hold on, it gets better. Speaking of, it gets better. And she goes, quote, I wish I'd stitched his effing hand to his balls.
Exactly.
That's how you know Claire's upset. Claire is upset because she does not threaten with surgery like that before. That is funny. So regarding Tom Christie being afraid of blood, yes, Jamie knew after he, I think I came up with the title. So after he'd been flogged and brought back into the cell, Tom Christie was the one who had gone off and barfed in a corner. Quote, I was the one was a bloody mess. Why was he taken on like a lass with the vapors? Mm-hmm. Unquote. And Jamie's flogging scars were visible, but also very personal. He never discussed the real purpose for them, which is why besides the fact that Tom Christie, everyone there had seen him get flogged at the time he got flogged in Ardsmuir. But that's not necessarily, I mean, he could have, even if those were the only flogging scars Jamie had, then Tom Christie still could have had the same dig, okay?
But I mean, he had the same dig, but he didn't have to be one.
No, it did.
Oh, I said, I'm like, his dick doesn't change because his attitude does.
No. What I'm saying is he could have had the same attitude if the only scars Jamie had on his back were from the flogging at Ardsmuir. But it was even worse because when they stripped him, or when he stripped himself to be flogged at Ardsmuir, everyone could see he already had a crap ton of flogging scars. So Tom was alluding to all of it. Who knows how long? We know how long, but, you know, Tom didn't know the history of the rest, and Jamie was not about to tell him. So as for now, Jamie had stayed and watched Claire with Tom because he knew that Tom would have done everything possible to remain lucid and conscious as long as he was there. He wouldn't have shown weakness or pain. And so what is Jamie's overall assessment of Tom? This is actually very interesting, given the little tete-a-tete they just had. Quote, a man stubborn enough to speak English to Hieland men in prison for 8 years is a man stubborn enough to fight beside me for the next 8 years. That's what I think. It would be good if he were sure of it himself, though. Unquote. So Jamie's assessment of Tom is, regardless of his attitude, he's a strong man. His will, he's strong, he's stubborn. And I would trust him to fight beside me. I just wish Tom had as much confidence in himself as I did. So that's very interesting, right? Another thing putting Jamie above Tom, like Jamie's the one who's being kind of persecuted, definitely persecuted as a Papist or as a Catholic, and also persecuted by Tom as a weakling, as someone who isn't honorable, when Tom has absolutely no idea why Jamie was flogged, the true story. Well, actually, that's not true. Tom may actually have an idea. He may know that Jamie claimed the tartan that wasn't his. I don't know.
Yeah, but he doesn't know about, he's like, oh, you get flogged a lot. Like, if you just saw Jamie's back for the first time and had no point of reference, you'd be like, dude. No, it's not even that this is nothing to him. It's just like, what the fuck did you get into? Because it's like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, for someone... Because generally, most people are not flogged within an inch of their life in one go, like Jamie was. Most of the time, it's like 10 lashes, 20 lashes. So it's like, if you have accumulated so many lashes, 10 at a time on your back to make that mess, you probably make a lot of mistakes and mess up a lot.
So back with Roger and Bree, they're in bed and they had been working on that sibling for Jim. Bree is finally calmed down, but we still don't know what she's done, except I already blurted it. They chat about getting pregnant, and she had implied when she was, you know, incandescent with rage that it was his fault. But she says, we don't know. It could be mine. It could be you. It could just be not the right time. But she does apologize. And they agree not to blame each other.
Yeah, they were getting really mean to each other. Like, she's like, clearly, I don't have a problem making babies.
Oh, baby girl. You, oh, gosh.
You, however, sir, we can't prove that you make babies yet.
Oh, Lord. She tells him about her next project and how it involves mostly water and dirt. And I mean, just a little bit of wood and burning, but nothing to be concerned about. Roger reaches over and takes one of her new inventions, matches. And he lights one, and he watches her by matchlight and blows it out just before it goes out on its own. And there's some Bible. There's Bible quoting all throughout this chapter. I don't think Tom actually, he knows his Bible. I don't think he quotes it. I think it's Jamie who talks like at least the wine thing. But then here, there's, I think, more quoting in the bed scene than in the Jamie and Tom scene. But it goes all the way around.
Yeah, I still stand by the fact that I think that those matches would have been pretty epic. I think she could have topped I'm not pregnant with, but look what I can make fire with a stick. I mean, come on. That's really impressive. I think that's way more impressive than popping a baby out, personally. And that was chapter 21. Join us next time when we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read along with chapters 22. Looks like a French word. I'm going to give that one to you, Ginger.
What? How do you spell it?
ENSORCELLMENT.
Okay, whoa. I got the first one. Oh, but okay, tell me again. Spell it again.
ENSORCELLMENT.
Oh, it's not French. It's English.
Well, I don't know that word.
Ensorcellment.
Are you sure? Because it looks like it should be like, ensorcellement.
It's an English word.
If you say so. And chapter 23.
Summer.
Entitled.
I'll check the dictionary. Where I heard Davina say it.
And chapter 23 entitled Anesthesia. I can do that one. I've been on that recently.
Yeah, it just means to bewitch or enchant.
In French.
It's in English. English has a lot of loanwords from French.
And if you'd like to continue the conversation, you can join us on our group at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And again, a special thanks to co-producer Raquel M. To find out more about what a co-producer is, you can go to patreon.com/outlanderpod. And Patreon is a place where you can support works, whether it be podcasts or artists or even journalists. There's so many people on Patreon, and what our Patreon is a way to support us, a very special way to support us. And we have three different tiers, and our top tier is called co-producer. And for $10 a month, you can be a co-producer. And so find out what that means and what it entails. As I said, go to patreon.com/outlanderpod.
And if you're interested in having my art on your face, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20. Outlander20 for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @outlanderpod. I dreamt it last night.